This is a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Chad Daybell back in the Fremont County Court today. Motions filed by John Pryor, Daybell's defense attorney, and prosecutors Lindsay Blake and Rob Wood regarding a change of venue for the trial, cameras in the courtroom, and taking the death penalty off the table, amongst other issues to be discussed today. Let's go right to the courtroom to hear the audio.
But if the defendant's free to argue what he wants. He's not free to say that we said things we didn't say, and he's not free to take snippets of what we said and ignore the rest of it. If he wants to go into what happened at Lori's trial, he has to take all of it, all the evidence, all the closing argument, the full 52 pages, and not just a handful of snippets. The state was clear in its closing argument and in its presentation of evidence. This was a conspiracy. There are three counts of conspiracy. There's no relative culpability in conspiracy. We never said that, and we're not going to in his trial. In conclusion, the defendant's argument has no basis in law. It has no basis in fact. The defendant ignored the vast majority of the state's argument to pick out a few snippets. The defendant ignored the vast amount of evidence presented at trial. This defendant asked for a severance, and he got it. So, of course, at Lori's trial, we focused on her because she was the defendant on trial. We will focus on Chad at his trial. We will present the same core theory. And the case law in the state's brief, while we will present that same core theory, we're allowed to do it in different ways. We're not tied to the exact same presentation of evidence. We're not tied to that. The case law is clear. As a matter of law, or as a matter of fact, it's a misrepresentation. It's a misrepresentation of what we said. As a matter of law, even if this court believed the factual representation, the law does not provide for this remedy. Conspiracy and the law of principle and aiding and abetting does not distinguish between who is more culpable or not. As such, we respectfully request this court deny the motion.
All right. Mr. Pryor, we're going to hear additional argument from Ms. Blake on the other two motions, but for now, I'd like to hear any rebuttal as it relates on the motion and limiting argument just provided by the prosecutor.
Judge, it sounds like what Mr. Wood is arguing is the relative culpability, and maybe I'm not being clear. I cited the U.S. Supreme Court case, I think it's Stumpf, that talks about inconsistent theories. And I appreciate Mr. Wood going through all the factual allegations of this case and all of the things that he's going to try to prove against Chad in this case to show that there was a conspiracy. And my argument, Judge, although I believe in this case that Chad was not part of a conspiracy, the argument here, Judge, isn't that I'm objecting to him trying to prove that there was some kind of conspiracy. What I'm trying to show is that Mr. Wood made specific representations, and he can say all he wants that I've misrepresented things, but it's really clear. It's in black and white, and it's in recording. And there are 52 pages of what Mr. Wood said in his closing argument. And the whole world out there can see what he said. And what he did say, Chad is not going to act without Lori saying so. It's in the transcript. It's a public record. And he said it. And he made a number of other representations that are in my brief. Now, he can do this snippet thing all he wants and say, oh, you took it out of context. The out-of-context argument occurs when you don't want to take responsibility for what you said in front of another jury pool. And what he said in front of that jury was clearly that Lori Vallow was the one driving this conspiracy, the conspiracy in this case. And rather than take argument from me or take argument from Mr. Wood, Judge, read the closing argument. I've pointed out what Mr. Wood calls the snippets. But the words are the same. And it's very clear that Mr. Wood made it very clear to that jury in Ada County that Lori Vallow was the driving force behind this whole alleged conspiracy. And this argument that there's no case law or anything to support this. Well, I cited the Supreme Court case, Judge. And the United States Supreme Court said he is not allowed to offer inconsistent theories. And it's an inconsistent theory for him to stand up in front of one jury pool and say to that jury, Lori was the driving force behind all this. Lori was the one in charge. Lori was doing this, 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 and this. And then turn around and say the exact opposite. Now, he can argue all the facts, and he did a very fine job of relaying to the public now all of the information that they intend to try to prove in this case. And I'm not going to take the bait and engage and show you all of the information I have. But what I will say is that the United States Supreme Court and also the case law in Idaho under the Pierce case cited by Ms. Blake talks about the fact that you're not allowed to offer inconsistent theories. And I would suggest to the court that an inconsistent theory is as simple as telling one jury pool or a number of jurors in Lori Vallow's trial that Lori was the one in charge and she was running the show. And if he turns around and goes in front of the Chad Daybell trial and says, oh no, what I told Lori Vallow's jury pool isn't what I'm going to tell you folks. Chad was actually the one in charge. That is an inconsistent theory. Now, all of the facts that he brought up about raccoons and all of the other stuff, he's free to do all that he wants. He can do everything he wants. Have at it. What he's not allowed to do, though, is suggest to a jury pool in Ada County in Chad Daybell's trial that Chad Daybell was in charge of this conspiracy. He can, if he's able to prove there's a conspiracy, have at it. He can do all of that. But what he can't do is stand up in front of that jury and tell them that Chad Daybell in any way was the one who was the driving force. And that's exactly what he said to the Vallow folks. He told them that Lori was in charge. Lori was in charge. And he can make all the representations. Oh, it's being misinterpreted. It's not being said. It's in black and white. I cited the site. I cited the transcript pages. I put the quotes that he said, the words he used, and it's in those documents. So I leave it to the court. You look at it, Judge, and you tell me whether he represented to a, in a court of law that Lori was in charge. And then if the court decides that Mr. Wood is allowed to change his theory and tell a different jury that, no, I told them one thing, but I'm going to tell Chad Daybell's trial a different thing, so be it.
All right. This is as it relates then to the motion in limine, which was filed on November 9th. We will hear in a moment state's response on the final two motions of the day, but I've considered the argument on this motion and I'm prepared to make a ruling at this point. I'll first note that some authority here on the standard I look at, a motion in limine is a request for a protective order to limit or exclude evidence at trial and applies only prospectively. The purpose of this type of motion is to avoid injection into trial matters which are irrelevant, inadmissible, and prejudicial. That case is State versus Wallmuller, 125 Idaho 196, Court of Appeals case from 1994. And then a civil case cites the same standard that applies here. A decision to grant or deny a motion in limine is left to the broad discretion of the trial court, and that's Gunter versus Murphy's Lounge, 141 Idaho 16, and that similarly, the trial court is afforded broad discretion in admitting evidence and will not be disturbed on appeal absent a clear abuse of the discretion, Chapman versus Chapman, 147 Idaho 756. So the motion for the court right now is a motion requesting that the court limit the state to certain arguments that are argued to be consistent arguments on the defendant's relative culpability. The state has countered that the citations provided in support of this motion are taken out of context. The court, having looked at the context and some of the citations in the state's brief, does agree that there were matters taken out of context in support of the motion. The underlying theory here of the state is a conspiracy charge between the conspirators, Chad Daybell, Lori Vallow, and Alex Cox, and others. That's been from the outset through the indictment in the case, the state's theory. The court presided through the trial with Lori Vallow and heard the state's theory at trial as well. The state correctly points to Idaho Code 19-1430 about abolishing the distinction between accessories and principles, which gives the state broad latitude in arguing their theory of the case as it relates to a conspiracy charge. And the question before the court right now is there something in the record which would require me under a motion in limine to prohibit certain conduct or argument from the state? And I don't find that there is anything brought in the motion that would prohibit the state in its theory of the case at this point. I will note clearly I do agree with the general premise that the state cannot come in and argue a set of facts A at trial number one and then turn around and argue distinct, separate, other different facts B at trial number two in the interest of trying to convict two individuals. There certainly would need to be some consistency in a theory of the case if the evidence is the same. However, I don't see any evidence that the state is engaged in that or is going to. If in fact at trial there is some contradictory argument made that directly contradicts evidence or argument made, the court would reconsider that ruling as it comes up at trial. That may be also subject to the impeachment of the defense to raise at trial, since the transcript of that first trial is all available. But for purposes of making a preliminary ruling on the evidence through this motion in limine, I don't find there's any grounds to grant the motion. So for that reason, I am denying the motion. We'll submit an order to that effect. Mr. Pryor, do you have any questions on that ruling?
Judge, I just want to be clear that given the fact that it was Mr. Wood that made the representations to the jury, what I'm reading the court's order is that if I find that, at least from my perspective, that Mr. Wood is making contrary, inconsistent representations, that that transcript, including the closing arguments, would then be available to the Mr. Daybell's jury for review. Is that what the court's saying?
Well, what I'm saying is you would have the ability to raise a motion at trial, and we would likely take that up outside the presence of the jury to, if you believed there was a clear contradiction, and we could head that off before the jury heard it, but I'm not making any ruling on that at this point, and I don't believe the state has done that. I don't think they will do that, but I think they understand how that would work, trying the second case with the same facts with a separate defendant. So we'll submit an order that for these reasons, based on the bench here today, the motion is denied. Mr. Wood, do you have any questions about that ruling?
Not at this time, Your Honor. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. What we'll conclude with then for now is, Ms. Blake, if you'd like to respond to the remaining two motions which were incorporated into Mr. Pryor's previous argument on the motion to strike the death penalty, due to the court striking the death penalty in Lori Vallow's case, and also the motion to strike the death penalty on relative culpability. I'll hear your arguments on those and then any rebuttal from Mr. Pryor.
Thank you, Your Honor. And I'll try to be brief with these as well. When we're looking at the potential imposition of the death penalty, there is a significant amount of case law regarding that. And turning to Kennedy v. Louisiana, 554 U.S. 407, a 2008 Supreme Court case, they reiterate that the Eighth Amendment provides that a person is supposed to be free from cruel and unusual punishments that may or may not be excessive. That court went on to note capital punishment must be limited to those offenders who commit a narrow category of the most serious crimes and whose extreme culpability makes them the most deserving of execution. There is a lot of case law that goes into the different factors, and they're outlined in our brief, and our brief is quite lengthy, so I won't go through all of them. But the common theme and the common thing that we see, and through a line of cases that have helped drive and create the death penalty procedures that we have in place now in each state, we see the common theme that it is supposed to be an individualized sentencing. The jury hears penalty information, including the aggravating and the mitigating circumstances. And we see time and time again where case law references that it is to be in an individualized capacity, taking into account the culpability of the offender, their participation in the crimes themselves, as well as the mitigating information. The mitigating factors are unique to each individual. And so when we talk about similarly situated co-defendants or similarly situated defendants in general, that's usually they are going to factor in all of those things. It isn't just limited to the culpability. There is some case law that talks about comparative culpability, but the majority of the case law cited in the defendant's motion deals with felony murder cases. There are a few that deal with conspiracy, but by and large, the bulk of the case law deals with felony murder, wherein individuals set out to commit one crime and someone is killed during the commission of that crime. In Tyson v. Arizona, 481 U.S. 137, a 1987 Supreme Court case, they specifically talk about the two factors that are determined, that are looked at when imposing death. And those include the deterrence, the potential deterrence, and the retribution, that are two purposes that are advanced by the imposition. And they cite to the Edmonds case, and the Edmonds case was a felony murder case. They determined that the main factor that they considered in the Edmonds case was that the defendant that had been sentenced to death did not intend or have the purpose to take a life. And they found in that case that it wouldn't be a deterrent to execute someone that had no intention to take a life. We find ourselves in a very different situation here based on the state's theory of the case. The state's theory with the conspiracy is that absolutely lives were intended to be taken, and not one, but three. When we look at the defendant's argument that he is being unfairly punished or potentially unfairly punished, and I think the state has raised before that we do not believe that these type of motions are ripe, based on Schaffer v. Reno, that's an 11th Circuit case, 55 F3D 1517, that indicates Eighth Amendment claims are not ripe when raised prior to actual or immediately pending imposition. I recognize the court has provided some differing authority on that, and we had a differing on that in the co-defendant's case. However, none of the cases cited by the defendant include cases where there was a predetermination made with regard to the death penalty. All of the cases cited and all of the cases cited and found by the state deal with a review conducted after the imposition of the death penalty, where a court was in a position to review all of the evidence presented, the findings made, looking at the mitigating, the aggravating factors, and or if a co-defendant was sentenced differently, why that occurred, and making that as a full determination in being able to review whether or not the death penalty was disproportionate or arbitrary and capricious in its imposition. I think we are well before even being in a position to try to make that determination. And looking at some of the cases that deal with some constitutional rights or choices given a defendant, we have U.S. v. Jackson, 390 U.S. 570. In that case, it was different because the statute was set out in such a way that a defendant had to choose between a jury trial. And if they chose a jury trial, there was the potential of a death sentence being imposed. If they chose a bench trial, there was no potential for a death sentence to be imposed. And the courts in that case said, that isn't fair. You're penalizing someone for exercising a constitutional right. By choosing to go to jury, now there's the potential for death. And they found that to be unconstitutional. Turning to State v. Lopez, 144, Idaho 349, that provides that a defendant's waiver of speedy trial is a voluntary relinquishment or abandonment of a known right. State v. Youngblood, 117, Idaho 160, went on to find that a knowing written waiver, is dispositive of a later motion to dismiss based on a defendant's waiver of speedy trial. There's no question the defendant in this case absolutely waived his right to a speedy trial. It is different from U.S. v. Jackson because when he chose to waive the speedy trial, there was nothing contingent upon his waiving that and the death penalty being pulled or being imposed. And I think the court previously made reference to that. The state announced the decision to seek the death penalty in the timely manner as required pursuant to statute and prior to the defendant opting to waive his right to a speedy trial. the potential imposition of the death penalty is in no way linked to his waiver of speedy trial. I know the defendant tries to argue that it is because the co-defendant, by not waiving her speedy trial, ultimately ended up making an argument and a successful argument to get the death penalty removed from her side of the case. The defendant at that time didn't opt to ask to have his motion to sever reconsidered. He didn't opt to ask to reconsider the motion to continue the trial. He didn't at that time try to join in a motion arguing in any way he was being unfairly treated or penalized for waiving his right to a speedy trial. Instead, her case went through trial. He had the benefit of observing that trial and has now brought some motions based on his observations of that trial, and only now is trying to bring this as a reason to have the death penalty pulled from his case. In Spanziano v. Beck, 468 U.S. 447, similarly, a defendant was given a choice. He could waive his right to statute of limitations on a lesser included offense and have the jury instructed on both what would be a capital offense and what would be a lesser included, or he could move forward with just the capital offense. He opted not to waive his right to that statute of limitations on the underlying offense, and the court found he chose to knowingly not waive that right. And when death was imposed, they determined that it was appropriate. Similar in this case, there is no question that Mr. Daybell, the defendant, absolutely opted to waive his right to a speedy trial. He had other remedies he could ask for, but the state's position would be in no way is the potential imposition of death linked to the defendant's waiver of speedy trial. The California Supreme Court in People v. Holmes, McLean v. Newborn, 12 Cal 5th 719, and also 503P3D668, states, it is well established that the punishment meted out to a co-defendant is irrelevant to the decision the jury must make at the penalty phase, whether the defendant before it should be sentenced to death. Again, that would follow the line of cases and the reiteration that when we're dealing with imposition of a sentence, it is individualized, and specifically with imposition or the potential imposition of a death sentence, it is supposed to be an individualized consideration. That clearly indicates the jury is not supposed to consider what happened in a co-defendant's case or what the sentence may have been in that case. The Ninth Circuit Court in Paradis v. Arrive, 20F3D950, and that's a Ninth Circuit from 1999, found the Supreme Court has determined that the death penalty is not a disproportionate punishment for those who kill, attempt to kill, intend to kill, intend that lethal force be applied, or act with reckless indifference to human life while playing a major role in the felony that results in the murder. Again, most of the cases cited deal with culpability as to each individual defendant involving felony murders rather than conspiracies. There are a few that were cited to and that deal specifically with conspiracies. And those include Lar Zellier, I'm going to say that wrong, I'm sure, v. State. And it's a Florida Supreme Court case, citation 676 South 2D394, and it's from 1996. And they determined that where there was a conspiracy, a co-defendant, that it was appropriate for her to be given the sentence of death, given the fact that it was determined that she was more culpable and that she was a mastermind and driving force behind a murder that was done for financial gain. Even though there were two others that were not charged and one co-defendant that was acquitted, the court upheld her death sentence as appropriate. In this case, when we talk about relative culpability, and I won't rehash it too much because it's been hashed out, but one thing that I will indicate with regard to the defendant is he has an additional count of first-degree murder over and above what his co-defendant has. He also has two counts of insurance fraud over and above what his co-defendant had. Those are specifically in relation to the death and the homicide of his wife, Tammy Daybell. When we look at that Florida court case, we're in a similar situation where the state's theory would be he was absolutely a moving, driving force behind that homicide and that it was done for financial gain. And while the co-defendant was charged in the conspiracy, he does in fact face an additional charge. In looking at People v. Kleiner, it's an Illinois Supreme court case 185, I'll give the other citation, 705 Northeast 2D 850, a 1998 case. And basically, again, that's talking about that when we're looking at an individual sentence, we have to look at the nature of the offense, each individual's relative involvement or culpability, the defendant's character or background, including any criminal record, and the potential for rehabilitation. In that case, they had determined that it was appropriate to give a trigger man a death sentence where the co-defendant who initiated the plan was not given a death sentence. The court upheld that in part given the background of the two. And again, could not be considered until all the evidence was presented and before a jury. One of the other major differences with most of the cases cited is they were not cases in which both co-defendants went to a trial. They were not cases in which the court pre one of the defendants going to trial had pulled the death penalty as a potential sentence. They are generally cases where a plea deal was taken or cases in which both went to trial and ended up with different sentences from their respective juries. The Idaho Supreme Court in State v. Gibson, 106 Idaho 54, it's a Supreme Court case from 1983, found that the death penalty is not an unduly severe punishment for an aider and abettor to a murder when that person intends that a killing takes place. Again, we see that intend language again and again in a lot of these cases and their review of it. What did the defendant intend that a homicide take place? In this case, again, the state's theory is absolutely the defendant intended for three homicides to take place, not just one. And again, when we talk about the culpability, I would just reiterate, contrary to the position raised by the defense, the state's theory of the case and belief has always been that Lori Vallow-Daybell, the co-defendant, and the defendant here today manipulated not only those around them, but each other, and that they did so with a common goal in mind, that goal of being together. To ultimately achieve that goal, it included the ending of three people's lives and had the underlying goals as well of financial gain and lust. So the state's position would be several things. One, that it would be premature to even make a determination if the court were to even consider that death should be pulled for any of the reasons outlined by the defendant at this juncture, that we would be premature until we see all the evidence presented and are able to weigh everything for the court to make an appropriate culpability analysis and relative culpability specifically. In addition to that, that would be if the court found any grounds to even consider that. The state's review of the case law, and as more clearly outlined in our brief, would be that the defendant fails to provide any valid reason or grounds or case law to support this court being required to remove the death penalty as an option. And to the contrary, that if the state has brought the death penalty, that it should be the jurors who make a final determination whether or not this crime or the crimes alleged are of such a nature that regardless of any mitigating evidence presented to them, that the imposition of the death penalty is appropriate. So we would ask that the court deny these motions at this time. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Blake, on the premature argument then, are you asking the court to defer ruling?
Our initial ask, and I probably said that backwards, our initial ask is that these just simply be denied. We think there are no grounds or basis or valid case law provided to support them. In the event that the court was going to consider either of these in any capacity, we believe that it would be premature to make that determination until the court makes a finding regarding culpability and relative culpability of the two. Again, as we outlined, Mr. Daybell, the defendant here today, has some additional charges that the co-defendant did not. We think with regard to the waiver of speedy trial, that in no way is even linked to the potential imposition of the death penalty or a reason to pull the death penalty as an option. With regard to the relative culpability, if the court were to consider that one at all, we think it's premature until all of the evidence is presented in the defendant's trial, including through the penalty phase, for the court to make a proper determination. We think it could be denied today simply because we don't think that it fits within the line of cases presented regarding, generally speaking, the felony murders.
Okay. So I just wanted to clarify that. So if it were a deferred ruling, your argument based on the case law you've reviewed would be the deferral is post-conviction and then after the penalty phase?
Yes, that would be. And I would also know, I don't think I had indicated this, but the Idaho statutes actually already provide for an automatic review regarding a death penalty and whether or not the imposition was appropriate. Idaho Code 19-2827, it specifically states, whenever the death penalty is imposed and upon the judgment becoming final in the trial court, the sentence shall be reviewed on the record by the Supreme Court of Idaho. So I think there actually is already a built-in review to make a determination whether or not the imposition of the death penalty is appropriate, which is the other reason that we would say this is premature to raise today.
All right. Well, I appreciate the clarification on that point. Mr. Pryor, you've heard the state's response to your two final motions. If you'd like to offer any rebuttal argument on either, you may at this time.
Judge, I will be extremely brief. I just want to point out just a couple of things. Judge, the at the time of the failure to provide adequate disclosure, the only difference between Ms. Vallow and Mr. Daybell was that Mr. Daybell waived his right to a speedy trial. Now, she's correct. It was a valid waiver of a speedy trial. They timely provided the notice of the death penalty, but the sanction that was imposed on the state for this failure was the pulling of the death penalty. That was not an option for Mr. Daybell. And what the culpability issue goes to, Judge, is simply this, is that if we're going to apply Mr. Wood's words about Ms. Vallow's involvement and Mr. Daybell's alleged involvement in this thing, the relative culpability simply is that if Mr. Daybell truly was the second wheel or a lesser wheel in this thing and Ms. Daybell was driving the ship, he's being punished for the waiver of his speedy trial. And I'm just, for purposes of this motion, Judge, I'm just preserving this for future consideration if there is a conviction of any kind, and that can be addressed at another court, Judge. Thank you.
All right, thank you. And I'll just make a final note and comment. I'm going to take the matter under advisement, but the court would note that at the time I made that ruling on the Lori Vallow case, I also made an explicit finding that the ruling there in no way impacted or affected the ability of the state to still seek the death penalty as it related to this case with Mr. Daybell. So with that in mind, I will take those matters under advisement. The court will issue a written decision on those as well. So that will conclude our argued motions for today. The court will get back with written orders and rulings on those matters under advisement. I appreciate counsel's briefing and arguments this morning and this afternoon. Mr. Wood and Ms. Blake, is there anything further to bring up on the matter today?
No, Your Honor.
Anything further from the defense?
No, Your Honor. Thank you for your consideration today.
Thank you. And thanks everyone in attendance for complying with the court's conduct order. I appreciate that as well. We'll be adjourned.
All right.
Let's see, so I'll wait to hear.
This has been a special report from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast.